Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight for our discussion on the mining industry. And the topic is mining, the super profits tax and the Australian economy. And we have two speakers tonight. George Megalogenis makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. He's been here a couple of times in the past, and Jennifer Hewitt makes her first appearance. Jennifer's going to lead off. Now, before I say that, I should say that Jenna Grundy's got some copies of the latest edition of George's book, The Longest Decade, which includes material about the 2007 federal election, and there are copies over there. Jennifer Hewitt's going to lead off. Both of our speakers are well known to you here tonight, so I'll be very brief in my introductions. Jennifer Hewitt is National Affairs Correspondent for The Australian. She comes originally from Western Australia, and she writes on business and politics for The Australian virtually daily. George Megalogenis spent 11 years in the press gallery in Canberra. He's now Melbourne-based for The Australian, where he's a senior writer, and he's a journalist, of course, and a published author. So we'll lead off with Jennifer Hewitt. We'll go to George Megalogenis. We'll then go to questions and discussion and finish no later than 7. Jennifer, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Well, good evening, everyone. When Anne asked me to talk about this issue a few weeks ago, I was happy to agree. She now tells me she was a bit nervous that things would have gone off the boil, but as we know, it certainly has not. And I think really, I've covered politics and business, but politics for a very, very long time, and I think this is the behaviour by the government is kind of extraordinary, so much so that I'm actually amazed, you know, anew almost each day when I think about this. And I think that the government has really behaved in a way which is going to actually cause the economy great long-term harm. And I don't think I've ever seen anything quite as important, which has been so inadequately approached and so badly understood by the government which is selling it. And usually, as a journalist, I certainly try, but I mean, actually, you usually do. You can see kind of good and bad in government policy. You can see that, you know, on the one hand this, on the other hand that, you know, like a typical economist. But this one's different. I remain almost incredulous at the idea that the way the government has approached this has actually any pluses for anyone, including, I might add, for the amount of tax that is actually likely to be raised as a result over this, because, you know, I don't think there's any doubt that investment in the mining industry will decrease rather than increase if the tax goes ahead as planned, and it's already done and is doing kind of damage to Australia as an investment destination over the long term, with people who, you know, all sorts of countries saying, what is Australia doing? I mean, Australia has been used to being regarded as a fairly stable investment destination, and suddenly in the last few months that has dramatically changed. I mean, that's a pretty extraordinary feat for the government. And in fact, the Prime Minister talks, you know, a lot, he was doing again today, about, you know, fact and fear. But actually, I think the gap between rhetoric and reality is always, you know, it's always an issue for any government, any politician, fair enough, for anybody, I suppose. But I don't actually think we've ever seen such a gap before between what Kevin Rudd, Prime Minister, has promised and what he's delivered. And in that sense, the resource tax is a big enough issue in itself, but it also acts, I think, as a lightning rod and demonstrates the other weaknesses of government. It reinforces and dramatically highlights the flaws in the structure of the government, the way it approaches things, the fact, for example, that Kevin Rudd does not consult, not just with the mining industry, but with his own cabinet, that he hates to hear, and he blocks out tough advice that he may be wrong and needs to reconsider. You know, the idea that, for example, the department of the minister, who the resources minister, who understands project finance, was completely left out of this whole thing until the very last minute is amazing. The problem with Kevin Rudd is, as a senior Labor figure told me when he was in opposition, that he always had to prove he was the smartest boy in the room. And rather than growing into the job and trying to draw on the breadth of the experience of his colleagues in a way that I think, for example, Bob Hawke did, he's used the Prime Ministership so far to concentrate that sense of power and superiority and to reject questioning of the notion that he still knows best and that he's still the smartest guy in the room. When that is revealed not to be true, certainly in terms of common sense applications of something like this mining tax, he is exposed very personally as well as politically, and I think that's what's happening now. Tony Abbott, of course, can hardly believe his luck. He calls it amateur hour and experimenting with Australia's future. But the point is, I think that actually has some validity because the government actually doesn't know how to get out of this dilemma. It wants to appear to consult and to compromise in the national interest, or at least it wants to appear to be doing so, but actually it's not quite sure whether it really does because, you know, this tax is very important to it, and it certainly wants to avoid any suggestion that it has backed down on what, its original proposal. And that is why you'll see here Kevin talking, incessantly about long-term reform, hard long-term reform. But in fact, there are many contradictory signals around at the moment. So the government earnestly says, they also know that the public likes things to be fixed, so that's why they say, well, they're engaged in real consultation and negotiation with the miners. And the Prime Minister is very keen to be seen to be taking charge of this. That's why he had private meetings with people like Marius Coppers and Andrew Forrest. And then just ahead of the news poll last week, he got Marius Coppers and David Peevers from Rio and Peter Freyberg to talk with Wayne Swan and Martin Ferguson. But so far, of course, to no avail. The miners actually do understand that this is about appearances rather than substance. They quickly put out a statement afterwards, for example, saying there was no formal acknowledgement the government would address their key concerns in terms of retrospectivity and competitiveness and stability. So what I think you'll see is that the government will try and do a few little separate deals and really talk them up in terms of how reasonable they are and how reasonable people are. Probably, I'm sure they'll do a deal with the coal seam gas industry, and that seems to be the most likely option. But there is no real sense that the government is prepared to radically rethink, and I think one reason is at the very top of government, as opposed to nervous backbenchers and so, certainly some ministers, they are still confident. They are still very confident that Tony Abbott is unelectable, and there is a firm belief that they can turn the tide on this tax and promote it as major reform in the national interest. They think the noise will go out of the debate and allow them to concentrate on issues of broader economic management and, for example, every day in Question Time this week, there's only been two, but we'll see it again for the rest of the week, they're talking all about broadband, for example, and this, is a great success in broadband, and the opposition only wants to talk about the mining tax. But this lack of consultation in terms of the mining tax, I don't think it's ever been the method of successfully getting through major reform in this country. And that's even when policy deserves the name of major reform. This actually does not. I think this is a self-defeating muddle-headed theory dressed up in the clothes of reform. And the interesting thing is that most voters, particularly in resource states like Western Australia or Queensland and South Australia, I don't think believe that they'll see this as reform. Now, the question is whether the government can do anything to get out of the mess it has created, and so far the signs aren't promising. Kevin Rudd really is not very convincing at being conciliatory. Wayne Swan, as we've seen over and over again, doesn't even try. The way that he's, the language he's used about some of the senior leaders in the mining industry, I think is just unprecedented, calling them, liars and incompetent, and then, basically accusing them of strong-arming others this week. I think he really does think it's just a scare campaign by Rio and BHP to avoid paying more tax. In that context, of course, it's interesting again to look at how this tax came about, and let's rewind to the 2020 summit and the enthusiasm of the government to have some concrete proposals out of it. And David Morgan, he was organising the business stream, and he pushed the idea of a comprehensive review of the tax system. And the government, very keen to have practical proposals to promote and say, yes, there was something that came out of this, leapt on the idea, and thus the Henley Review was born. But there were lots of problems with this review when it was eventually delivered last December, including the fact the government had no clue what to do with it and was very nervous about how to cope with the idea that they had this big review and they didn't actually want to implement most of it. But now we know what they did do, and that was the Treasurer went up to for his surfing holiday and read the Henry report and kind of came up with this, you know, grand plan of a mining tax, which suited the government in a variety of ways. It fits in neatly with traditional Labor orthodoxy and the belief which requires a special tax on non-renewable resources. And that dates back as a Labor ambition, you know, right back to the 1970s. Of course, Ken Henry tried to widen that, you know, again in a very extraordinary intervention yesterday by saying a super profits tax should apply to all sorts of industries, but the government quickly shut that down today. But the Hawke government introduced the petroleum tax in the mid-1980s as a direct result of this belief in taxing non-renewable resources. And this was, of course, a new industry, not affected by state royalties so much, and it was regarded as a relative success. So that's why then they came to this idea and thinking they could actually replicate the same thing, except in Ken Henry's view, he had a much better idea, an even more elegant, you know, economic theory that he could try and actually persuade the government of. And golly, he actually was able to. I mean, in that sense, I do blame the politicians more than the public servant. Ken Henry was, in that sense, just doing the job he was given. And it was up to the politicians to realise and to actually try and find out and talk to people to discover that the elegant theoretical model that he devised needed real-life exposure before being unleashed as policy. But as we know now, those politicians did not do that, deliberately did not do that. And there, I think that means that there's now no doubt that the combination of Kevin Rudd, Wayne Swan and Ken Henry, and they were the three who did this, who drove all of this, the rest, you know, really were just kind of came along for the ride. I think that the combination of them actually turned out to compound each other's errors and judgments so that the sum of the whole was worse than any of the parts. I was deeply sceptical about the tax from the day it was announced on May 2, perhaps because I'm from Western Australia, but the more I learned about it, actually the more horrified I became. I mean, everyone can say, oh yeah, the principle of more tax is fine, the principle of a profit-based tax is fine. But then you actually go into it and you see how they've done it, and it's almost incomprehensible. The impact, I think, was, if anything, a slow burn even amongst the mining industry. I remember a telling line from someone clever saying that anyone who wasn't confused about the mining tax didn't understand it. And it did take a while for the disaster to sink in on the industry. And they also had to get over, and you mustn't underestimate this, they had to get over a sense of disbelief, but also betrayal. They had actually been deliberately kept in the dark for months. They had been told over and over by the government, don't worry about it. We won't do anything dramatic until we talk to you. You know, about what you must do is not complain in public. Don't raise this in public, and things will work out fine. And then, of course, they were completely ambushed on May 2. So imagine their surprise. And now, ever since, the government's been basically saying to them, you know, just you should need to quieten down this public debate. Just quieten down, and things will work out. And of course, you know, oddly enough, they don't believe the government anymore. So I think that demonstrates that the government was actually very arrogant in how it handled this from the beginning. It needed to be able to sell its commitment to tax reform, particularly as it wasn't doing anything else particularly, and it needed to get money to get its budget back into surplus. What better than tax on the mining industry? And I think it's hard to overestimate here the grievous errors of both politics and policy. The politics, first, when the government announced its new tax, it was keen to say, it said it at the time, I remember when I was in the lockup, that it expected a well-funded scare campaign. They didn't say they thought it would come almost entirely from BHP Billiton and Rio Tinto and would be relatively easy to counter politically. I thought that was still, you know, strange logic, but they thought they could relatively easily demonise big miners, particularly those with dreaded foreign shareholders, while talking about superannuation and tax cuts to small business and extra infrastructure. It was the whole fair share thing for Australians, and who could argue against that? I think this badly underestimated the increased sophistication of Australians about the causes of their relative wealth and the notion that perhaps there were risks in targeting the industry that the government had just spent so long boasting about as one of the key strengths, apart from themselves, of the economy. The government also thought that though companies like Rio and BHP would complain, given they'd be liable for, you know, a lot of that tax, the government's guarantee of a 40% concession rate for expenses, even if projects went bad, would be very popular amongst small miners. Well, you know, Paul Keating used to say that good politics followed good policy, but this miscalculation was truly remarkable on any number of levels, and I think it demonstrates really how bad politics follows really bad policy. Because, of course, naturally the small miners, if only that had been asked, could have told them instantly that this wouldn't help them get financing for their projects in any way. And people like Andrew Forrest at Fortescue Metals explained Fortescue wouldn't exist if the tax had been in place a few years earlier because he wouldn't be able to get project financing. I mean, nobody believed the government's, you know, concession or concessional rate. It wasn't the right uplift factor or the right rate anyway. But even beyond that, it didn't convince bankers. Miners didn't value it. That didn't actually seem to make much immediate difference in Canberra. Because they really simply refused to acknowledge the real world in their figurings. Treasury had never done project financing. I never forget going to a briefing soon after the budget, which was, you know, pretty... George was there as well. It was pretty extraordinary. You know, Ken Henry was actually quite proud of the fact and again repeated this in public a week later, that he had not consulted bankers or miners because he was very pleased with his superior theoretical model and he thought it made much more sense not to have to deal with pesky complaints from people who didn't understand or appreciate economic theory. And the fact that the Treasury didn't understand the market, how the market worked, didn't seem to faze him anyway. And when banker after banker and miner after miner explained to him that this model wouldn't work in the real world and it would cost a lot more money than the government bond rate, even if money were available, he had another answer. I remember because I asked him this question in a public forum, and he said, well, people like Macquarie Bank and all other financial engineers, smart financial engineers, they'll come up with a way to make big money out of this without needing assistance from taxpayers. So somehow I thought the people who thought the markets couldn't be trusted, who need the government as a silent partner to make projects feasible, were somehow relying on those supposedly dreadful greedy financial engineers to find solutions for the big gaps, big practical gaps in the government's model. But as I said, you know, the people who in the end are responsible are the politicians. Wayne Swan, I think, was always aware of his inexperience as a treasurer, and that's one of the reasons that he thought, even from opposition, and announced that they would involve Treasury far more heavily in all their government policy making. And, you know, that was one of those things which seemed a very, very good idea at the time, and Treasury felt that it had been left out, really, by the Howard government. And we used to jokingly refer to Treasury as Wayne Swan's security blanket. But the trouble was that I think Wayne Swan went too far and seemed to believe that most ideas from Treasury could be just, you know, delivered, and particularly this one, without putting it through the real-world filter. And one of my friends joked that his own security blanket had electrocuted him. and challenged, you know, what's interesting is that he's only become more aggressive. It's actually awakened his old Queensland bobble boy instincts. And that includes, you know, the use of dodgy statistics to prove the theory, by Treasury, thus undermining its independence in a way which, again, I think is, rather concerning. And it may well be the case that miners can pay a moderate amount more tax, and it may well be the case that, in principle, a profit-based tax makes sense. But that argument has actually been degraded, completely degraded, by the heavy-handed way the government has tried to bludgeon its way into political advantage. Kevin Rudd's better than Swan at telling different audiences different things according to what seems to suit at the time. And he does, in the past, he has been able to charm people a little bit more, even though people are now kind of incredibly wary and dismissive of it. But it is, and it is hard. The reason is it's very hard to get away with that level of inconsistency when you're Prime Minister. You eventually trip yourself up and voters start adding up the contradictions. Yet it was Rudd and Swan who, in alliance with Ken Henry, believed they had all the answers on this, and that, of course, has led to the question that voters are asking, in combination with some of the other things that have gone wrong, the most dangerous question of all, you know, and that is this government competent when it comes to managing the economy? And once that takes hold, it's, you know, that is very difficult for the government, and that is why you are seeing, I think, you know, such an extraordinary fight back and from them to try and win this argument. And so far, of course, they are failing. I will finish with one of the more chilling comments that somebody, a Labor Party person, said to me, and that, you know, was probably not the most politically correct thing to say, but they said, well, look, you know, Tony Abbott, we say Tony Abbott's got all sorts of problems with his economic credibility, his understanding of business, and that is a very salient and valid criticism. But our problem is we're looking as though we've got a Prime Minister, a Treasurer, and a Deputy Prime Minister with the same problem. And that, of course, is a broader problem for the country. Thank you.
And sorry, thank you, Jared, and thank you, Jenny. Now, I'm going to take this in a slightly different direction. I will explain why we need a tax on profits, on mining profits, but I'm going to stick up for the idea of government in this debate, not the Rudd government or the previous Howard government or the Keating government or the Hawke government or, heaven forbid, the Fraser or the Whitlam governments, but the idea that a government can move policy and be judged on the content of the legislation it presents to the Parliament, as opposed to the debate that we're having at the moment. Now, Jenny makes a couple of powerful points, but a lot of these points are the pushback from a lobby group that has economic weight that's out of all proportion to any other lobby group in Australia at the moment. And the Coalition thinks that the ACTU played them off the break in the response to work choices, but I think there's something to bear in mind about the ACTU campaign in 2005 and 2006, and that the dollars the trade union movement brought to the table in that advertising campaign, we'd seen the legislation first. There'd been a bit of advertising that happened beforehand, but the campaign really began after the ACTU lost the fight in the Senate. Now, I still believe Parliament's preeminent in these matters. I think the reason why you elect people to Parliament is so they can consider legislation. And if you have a problem with legislation, I think you go to your parliamentarian to knock it off in the Senate. I think if you don't get the outcome you want in the Senate, then it's probably all bets are off in a public campaign. But I have a real problem now with the deepest pockets in Australia, and it could be anyway. Imagine if the ACTU had done this in 2001, ahead of the 2001 election when the Coalition weren't looking so crash hot, or in 1998 when the Coalition weren't looking so crash hot. Say with the GST. Now, the GST is a really interesting example and a really interesting case study. A lot of detail dumped on the electorate 2 weeks before an election was called. A lot of the negotiation happened after the election, but it never occurred to anyone through the 97-98 period to tell the government what their tax rate should be. ACOS never walked up to the Howard government and said, oh, by the way, we want to argue the toss on the 10% tax. The people really have to have a say in these sorts of things, but you can't really have these sorts of debates if we haven't seen the thing on paper. We have a proposal from the Henry Review, which is independent. We have stuff that's been put into the budget, and now we have a negotiation on the day, and this is the thing that the miners will never tell anybody. On the day the proposal was released on May 2, there was this bit of paper that said, by the way, a lot of things are up for grabs, including the transition. Now, transition, these debates can mean anything to a government and to a lobby group once they sit down and argue the toss. Transitions can mean anything from how soon this tax starts to take a bite in your pocket to whether you apply it even in the model proposed. The government have said, and they've said this quite clearly, now I'm not sticking up for the government here, I'm sticking up for the idea that a government can move this sort of proposal in the first instance. The government has said that the things that are not on the table for negotiation are the rate. Now, a 40% rate, whether you like it or not, is really a government's call. And it becomes a Parliament's call after that. It doesn't become the call of the deepest pockets in Australia, whether they're a mining lobby or whether they're the ACTU, to preempt the parliamentary process. Now, there's a lot of discussion about whether the government is negotiating in good faith, and there's a pretty strong case to be said that the government are not really interested in negotiating on the terms that BHP and Rio especially are seeking. But the miners have been offered a consultation process. They're already in the public space, belting the government on their head. Now, why did they choose to do that? A, because they could. B, I suspect, because we need, after this example has been dealt with by the political system, we need to reconsider political advertising, because the idea that a lobby group can deploy the sorts, any lobby group I'm saying, can deploy the sorts of resources that the miners have been able to deploy in this debate whilst running a parallel discussion with the government, I can't find a precedent in our modern public life where you've had two sides in the public space talking behind closed doors, but one side having, you know, a 3-to-1 advantage in the advertising game. Now, I prefer that the government didn't do what it did and backflipped on its own legislation on use of taxpayer funds to promote government policy. We don't know what the policy is yet because we don't have legislation. It stands to reason then that the government should not be in the public space with a campaign. I don't want to call this a score draw. I actually want to change the game. I suspect from here on, both sides of politics are going to consider the danger of having these sorts of debates run in the electronic media. Now, we don't ban electronic advertising the final 2 days of a campaign for no reason. People believe that there's something about the electronic media that can get into a voter's head that may or may not give them time to properly consider an issue. Whilst a policy is being negotiated with the sector, you don't want to see these ads. But you've got to think about this as citizens. You don't want to see these ads because you don't want to see rank pulled on your parliament. Now, when we see the legislation, we can pick the eyes out of it and we can say that this government should rise or fall on the strength of that legislation. But they do, as a first principle, have a right to put this legislation through, to present it after they've considered all the feedback. Now, I'm going to go back to the GST because the GST raises a very interesting... These are completely different taxes, and I'll... For argument's sake, we'll call the tax the resource super profits tax. We won't call it by its jargon. We'll call it by what Treasury call it within the bowels of that department. It's the Aretha Franklin tax, as in R-S-P-E-C-T. Find out what it means to me. So they do call it the Aretha tax. So for shorthand, I'll be talking about the Aretha tax or the GST. Now, everyone's familiar with the story of the GST. The policy was first mooted in a report that the Whitlam government didn't even commission. That was in the Ashby report that came out in 1975. John Howard tried a couple of times in government as Malcolm Fraser's treasurer to get the thing up, and on one very famous occasion was humiliated by his prime minister because the prime minister of the day decided to tell Michelle Grattan that the tax had been knocked off before it went to cabinet, and then John Howard still had to go through the cabinet process to get the thing knocked off. Now, the GST obviously is quite familiar to us now because it was such a long and strange journey. Paul Keating had a crack at it in 85. John Hewson had another crack at it in 93. John Howard brought it back again in 1998. Now, what happened in 97 and 98 is still very pertinent to what is going on today. The Labor opposition, and they'd only been out of office for a couple of years, and they saw the opinion polls do exactly what the opinion polls have been doing to Kevin Rudd at the moment. And in fact, if you track News Poll primary vote for the government of the day in 98 and 2010, you get an almost perfect fit. And at the same point in the cycle, by the middle of 1998, John Howard was in free fall. He had a primary vote in the mid-30s. One Nation had sort of blown up to the right. Labor was still tracking on a soft primary vote at around 40, not dissimilar to the primary vote the Coalition record today. It didn't occur to anyone then to go into the public space to knock off the GST, which was then still to be announced. But we knew we'd have a GST. It did occur to Kim Beazley, for some strange reason, that he'd be back in one term. So what he did was basically say no. Missed a great opportunity at the end of the 90s for Australia to set up a good reform debate going into the 21st century. What we got instead was a Labor Party that thought the quickest way back to power was to oppose this thing. But they didn't even get their tactics right. They didn't oppose the thing and then say, if the public vote for it, you can have your way in the Senate, as Paul Keating had probably a little more honourably said going into the 1993 election. If, after the scare campaign had been mounted and the public still voted for John Hewson, Paul Keating's attitude was, you can have the GST. If Kim Beazley had made that choice, he would have clarified the issue for voters a bit better. What actually Beazley did in 98 was give people the licence to vote coalition in the lower house and take out the insurance in the upper house of the Democrats, who, unlike the Labor Party, were prepared to engage in tax reform at that level. Remember, the Democrat proposal in 1998, going into that election, was that food wouldn't be in the base. And of course, the Democrat plus coalition positions met at some point after Brian Harradine knocked off the tax. Sorry, Brian Harradine said he could not support the tax. Now, what we discovered as journalists through the GST debate wasn't really apparent at the time in 1998. Now, what I'm suggesting to you in the first instance is that Kim Beazley, and I'll come back to Tony Abbott in a minute, Kim Beazley is Tony Abbott, and Tony Abbott is Kim Beazley in this story. Ken Henry is still Ken Henry in this story, and so is Greg Smith, who was also on the tax review panel, worked for Treasury at the time. Now, I remember picking up the modelling, on the day of the lockup that had everyone a winner from the GST. And one of the tricks in the modelling, which it took me a day and a half to work out, but once you'd worked it out, you knew that this story was going to run and run and run. They took a snapshot of the electorate, of all households, 2 years after the introduction of the GST and said, oh, by the way, you're all better off. And then they imposed an assumption across every household that everyone's cost of living was the same, everyone's household expenditure was the same, therefore the GST would have roughly equivalent effect on everybody. Now, it turned out that there were quite large variations between families with kids, self-funded retirees, pensioners, singles and the like. Now, we didn't find this out until the death. At the end of the last Senate committee hearing, 9 months into the second term of the Howard government. And it was Greg Smith who actually built the cap. He said, oh, by the way, in the transition year, there will be some losers. Now, the ERESA tax has roughly the same presentational problem that the GST had. Now, Ken Henry was doing his job for Peter Costello, and it's probably done his job for Wayne Swan as well. He's told you what the story is in the long run. Now, there are arguments about whether this thing in the long run, whether the long run is a 5-year long run, a 10-year long run, or a 50-year long run. But fundamentally, what the ERESA tax does, by taxing profit instead of production, it replaces a thing called a royalty. Now, miners want you to think that they pay more tax than anyone else at the moment, which they do. But miners have always paid two taxes. There is essentially a licence fee for digging the stuff out of the ground, and then they pay company tax, and they get a rebate on the royalty they pay. Now, the ERESA tax works in a slightly different way. Its pressure point, it applies after money is made. A royalty applies, the royalty is essentially a license to explore. So basically it applies regardless of how much money the mine's going to make. Now, over the long run, if you tax the profit as opposed to if you tax the production, you do tend to get over the long run more production. Now, the question in the transition, which the model doesn't answer, and again, there were questions in the transition, the GST model that were dug out in Senate estimates, is that you probably have a slowdown of production in the short term. There are big debates to be had about the revenue estimates, but see, all these things are the domain of the Parliament and the domain of the officials who are elected to Parliament to run the country. This is why I come back to the first principle here. I don't want to see a government, any government, lose to a lobby group before a government has been able to tell us the detail of its legislation. The reason why I don't want to see that is, just imagine what the next election is like. Tony Abbott gets over the line, coalition exceeds its wildest expectations and has a workable majority in the lower house. But, because we know the polls are pretty screwy at the moment, the Greens are also going to get the upper house. They're going to get a balance of power in the upper house. Now, Tony Abbott is going to come to power on roughly the terms that Kim Beazley saw power in 1998. I blocked this tax. I didn't come up with an alternate proposal, I just blocked this tax. And I blocked this tax on behalf of a lobby group that got to do stuff that no other lobby group has ever dared do in the Australian political system. I run a guerrilla war ahead of the release of the legislation. So Tony Abbott becomes Prime Minister the day after. Somebody says to him, well, you've still got this thing called a mining boom on. What are you going to do to catch the excess profit? Now, the miners will tell you, we can pay a bit more if you come up with a better model. Now, the job of politics is to come up with a better model. The job of politics isn't for one side to say, here's a theoretical model, I'm going to negotiate, maybe I don't really want to negotiate, but what I'm really looking for is a mandate, but trusting the Parliament to get it right in the long run. Or here's another side of politics that says, oh, look, I see the Prime Minister's having trouble with the polls at the moment. The longer I block this, the sillier he looks, I get power. But what happens the day you get power? And you've got a Labor Party that says, well, the simplest way back into power is to say no again. And you're going to have the Greens with the balance of power. You're going to have a rather strange configuration in federal politics that I haven't seen in my lifetime, which is essentially a regional and a small state majority in the lower house, which is not a Victoria and New South Wales majority, but a West Australian, South Australian, Queensland majority. All power and all credit to Tony Abbott if he can pull it off, especially after what was a very popular government until 6 months ago. But you're going to have a metropolitan balance in the Senate. Now, the States House suddenly becomes the chamber of the inner cities because the Greens are going to have the balance of power. Now, what sort of country are we looking forward to if that's the situation after the election? Now, the reason why we're in a situation like this is that everybody thinks that the answer to a question is what they thought of that morning. And if the thing is an implement at that time in the afternoon. Now, the media has a bit of a responsibility here too, as every political practitioner and every lobby group in Australia has responsibility. We've had an avalanche of information in the new tech era. In the last 10 years, everybody's been coping with this seeming contradiction in public life, that you've got access to much more information than you ever had. Politicians think they can control the story a bit better now, simply because they can Google their enemy and Google their own information to suit their own argument. But somehow, our public figures are diminished by the amount of time that they need to turn up each day to feed the media beast. No question is too small for a Prime Minister now. No doorstop is too weird for an opposition leader if he's wearing a crash helmet. What sort of celebrity kick are we on? But that's what we've reduced politicians to. I know they did it to themselves, and I know there's a bit of journo brain ticking in both Kevin Rudd and Tony Abbott that says, I can do this, you know, I understand the media. But the thing is, what's been lost here, and this is one of the reasons why the Rudd government looks so shrill and why the Aretha tax seems to have come out of the bolt out of the loo for everyone, is because everybody expects this thing to be wrapped up in a week or a day. Not a month, but a week. And people hang out for the next news poll and say, oh, well, he doesn't look so good, maybe he should drop the thing. Government shouldn't drop things because one poll turns against them. I'll take you back to the GST. The GST was never popular in its own right. The news poll polled this every which way, and I wrote some of the questions, so I know what sort of questions you're asking your households. Nobody ever accepted the tax in its own right, and even after implementation, it was as unpopular as it was first mooted by John Hewson. Not John Howard, John Hewson. But the thing is, you ask people the other question, do you think it's a good idea for the country? Well, by that stage, it had been well and truly debated, and it had been sold and implemented, and people wanted to move on to another issue. You don't tip a government out just because the government proposes a tax that people are uncomfortable with. In fact, you encourage your government to do this sort of stuff. Now, this is why I come back to the first principle here. I don't think the mining industry should be in the public space. I know they think they should be, and I know they've got some good people working for them. Some of my friends work for them. But I'll just leave you with one last thought. Nikki Savage's got a very interesting checklist of the people who work for the mining lobby. And just think about the political talent from both sides of politics that now work for either the Minerals Council, BHP or Rio. As I said, some of them are good friends of mine. But this is a classic example of crowding out. If the best political talent in Australia is going to where the bucks is, and the dollars are where they are, they're in WA basically, and these dollars are the sorts of dollars that no one's ever seen before in PR and in government relations, and no other business, you think that some businesses might have a better story to tell than the miners at some point, no other business can compete with the mining lobby at that level. Now, the reason why you should barrack for government on a debate like this is the right to tell us what their legislation looks like before it gets knocked off. Now, we can go into the detail of the tax, and I've got chapter and verse on the criticisms of the way that things have been done and some of the detail, but I think just wanted to leave you that threshold thought first. Our system might change if the result of the next election is that people tick a box and say, well, I go BHP, a change of government.
So we come to questions and discussion, and as I said, Janet Grundy's got some copies of George's The Longest Decade, latest edition, right down the back.
George, it's a pretty convoluted argument. At the end of the day, we need a democracy. Everybody's got the right to be able to point forward, and I think that the argument that because they've got two comments, nullifies their right to the argument. You also say that the government is in power, the incumbent, also has a treasury behind it. So, I mean, this sort of cancels itself out. But the worst thing for argument is that it assumes that the voters are stupid. You can't listen to both sides of the argument and make a decision.
George, can you just come up here? Yes. If you just stand up here, and you may just very briefly repeat the question, which is a suggestion that George thinks the electorate's stupid.
Well, I haven't suggested that, but it's an interesting question you raise, and this is one of the things I wrestle with before I make a presentation like this one. The voters aren't stupid, but there is something about the electronic media that both sides of politics want to control. Now, I've got a slightly different take on this. I don't care that politicians struggle to get messages out. That doesn't bother me at all. I think debates like this ought to be had through free media. Now, I don't mean people should ring me up and I work out whether to write the article or not. I think there's a point in these sorts of debates where, you know, a 60-second commercial on TV that dominates people's state of origin coverage, which is not the level of detail for a tax like this that you want to be having this debate at. Now, the Coalition found this problem when they're doing the Unchain My Heart campaign, which is why the Aretha tax is such an interesting thing, because they're hooked on soul music and Treasury for some strange reason. But that was just garbage. That ad was just garbage. Now, the idea of that ad was not, by the way, ring this hotline to find out if you're a small business how to do your business activity statement, because small businesses found out really quickly that nobody knew how to do the thing, and the ad didn't help them do that. These ads are about stopping something from even being presented to the Parliament. That's my concern. That's my first concern. The second concern is your democracy is much more healthy if you don't have the sort of escalation in these sorts of bidding wars that you do in the American system. You know, we've got a presidential campaign style of politics at the moment, and has been presidential, you know, since Whitlam's day. But we've never had this thing, because we have publicly funded election campaigns, we've never had this thing that the deepest pockets can buy the biggest voice in the public debate. Now, it's something in our system I think that we want to cherish, and I don't think we want to mess with it lightly, because the retaliation from the union movement is going to be uglier than the one the miners have started with.
Okay, so there's a question here and then here. Yep. Yeah.
Is that
George, just take that seat here.
Yep.
And yes, who? Right. Yes, so who's this?
Yes. I'm just because I know a little bit about maths and a little bit about economics and things like that, and so I can think in numbers to a minor degree. And I just think that like BHP Rio will be paying 80%. Is so 80% of that sort of tax. Terms of the $9 billion and then $12 billion after that. So if they take 80%, if simple modelling from BHP and Rio indicate that their tax goes from 40% to 58%, that's 50% increase in tax.
Yep.
Anyone who's faced with a 50% increase in tax, I think, has got a right to say, I think that might be a bit too much.
Again, that is a fair point. But BHP and Rio are not making the sort of money they're making now because they're digging the stuff out of the ground faster. This is a unique product. This is a product that no competitive market can actually... The addition of a new entrant is not going to bring the price down. China have quadrupled the price for our quarry. It doesn't matter who digs it up. Somebody's going to dig it up. The idea here is, and this is... we'll go to the detail, because the details are pretty important. The government could have sold this a lot better if they'd literally followed through the logic of what Henry was arguing in the original report, which is that it should be a one-for-one trade-off. Whatever money you raise from the resources sector ought to be given back to the economy as a whole. The quickest route for that is a cut in company tax. I don't understand why they've unbundled the benefit from the tax. Now, if you cut the company rate by 5 or maybe even 10 cents in the dollar, that average tax rates for BHP would be a lot lower. Now, you'd still have the revenue, but the transaction for the company would be a lot better. There's a couple of ways I can fix this, and one of the ways I can fix this is just to do away with the idea of the 40% buy-in from the government. Now, for those not aware of the detail, Once a profit reaches a certain point, once it goes into China territory, the mining company doesn't have to do anything more to make money. It just has to turn up. The 40% tax applies. But for a project that loses money, the Commonwealth's going to kick in 40% of the losses. And no one wants that. So if I were a government, I'd say, okay, theoretical model doesn't work for you guys. There's nothing to be lost in the government saying you get to choose between two tax rates. You can choose a theoretical model, or you can choose, you know, a compromise model. Now, and people can then vote with their tax returns in the long run. I actually don't have a problem with them. I want to maintain their dignity, actually running two options, because people did have, with the petroleum resource rent tax, a couple of options when the thing started. You do have, say, with capital gains tax, option of which regime you want to be under, depending on when your asset was purchased. So it's not, these things aren't that complicated. Now, getting back to the bite, and I'm at one with Jenny on this, I think one of the structural flaws in what the government is trying to do is that they wanted to collect the money on day one. Now, some of the best reforms of the 80s and even the GST going into the last decade had a really slow start. They had long fuses but very, very slow fuses as well. When they went off, nobody noticed. The world had changed. Capital gains tax started as, what, a $10 million a year. The first couple of budgets, you looked at it and you think, well, why are they doing this? They grandfathered everything before 1985. You know, it's a multi-billion dollar tax now. It's an important part of the base, notwithstanding the fact that the rates, the effective rate's been halved since the Ralph Report in 1999. Fringe benefits tax is the same. And a lot of the base broadening that was done first on wholesale sales tax by Keating in 85 and now with the GST, the thing collects more money. This resource rent tax, if it's properly structured, could be collecting a good deal of money by the end of the decade, which is really when you should be thinking as a government. Your reform story should always be a long story, and you should have the courage of your own policy formulation to let the government after you collect the windfall. Jeff Kennett found this much to his chagrin in Victoria, but he left Steve Brax with a pretty tight budget and not a bad working model for a state. 10 years later, people still look at Victoria, especially in this state, and say, how the hell did they do that? And how do they manage to transition from one government to another without losing the model? At the moment, I think we're in danger of losing the whole idea of a reform model in Australia simply because we're now to the generation of politicians who want an instant fix in a poll or in a headline in the paper. But getting back to your question, BHP and Rio have every right to say you're squeezing us too much. But a government has every right to say BHP and Rio can't argue for the existing system. The existing system is actually not the sort of thing you would want as your model for a long run, especially when you're running a big mining boom. Australia has never managed its booms well in the past. This one, they've done pretty well up to this point, but I think this is one of those critical tests of the policy of whether we've actually got institutional means to reform.
I want to ask Jenny to more fully explain the reasons you said it was a mess, and I agree with the lady on the back. I don't think taxpayers or the citizens of Australia are stupid, and I don't think governments are so wonderful all the time that they can't answer to the wishes of the people outside of an election. So what I would like from Jenny is to find out why you say it's a mess. You obviously know that it's a mess. And going back to Peter Costello's piece some weeks ago, that this is really the problem of process, consultation, and a well-informed policy.
Yeah, well, I guess there's quite a few elements to that. I certainly don't have the same problem that George does with advertising when confronted with a government that just went boom, that's it, no discussion, no talk, no consultation. And it's all very well to wait for the legislation. Well, actually, that'll be, you know, a long time ahead, and the government's already said, you know, actually there's going to be no debate. There's going to be no debate on the 40% tax rate, which is a very big hurdle. It's not just replacing royalties or getting rebates for royalties. They're actually kind of trying to get a very much bigger increase. So there's that issue. There's also the issue that that their model doesn't work. I mean, in terms of their... I mean, Ken Henry thinks that this whole idea of the concessional rate is worth a huge amount, and actually to companies. I mean, and it's, you know, it's actually not worth anything to anyone. So that is a kind of a fundamental flaw of the whole theory of the tax. And I think, therefore, that people have to be able to have this explained to them. And the fact that the government wasn't willing to have, you know, George said, oh, well, you can't, you know, be having a public, public advertising campaign and private negotiations. But the point is about this, the government is actually not interested in private negotiations on this. And one of the issues has been, they say they are, but actually they're not. And of course, some members of the government are, but of course, they also need the financial backing, the Treasury, the backing, and guess where they have to get it from? They can't go out and get outside economists. There's plenty of them who say, actually, this will not raise money, this will actually discourage investment, or do all these sorts of things. They have to rely on Treasury, which is so wedded to its, you know, its baby. It's not going to actually kind of give up ground to it, and that's where I think you've kind of got this confusion, great confusion at the moment. And there is, I think, also a complete misunderstanding, which was, again, amazed me. I mean, Treasury says, oh, well, resources aren't mobile. So therefore, you know, it doesn't matter. They can't. But of course, they forget this. You know, this whole crucial point that capital is mobile. Capital is mobile. And you've got, so they came up with an idea which we suggested from the very beginning, they wanted to encourage marginal projects more and also kind of help them if they, you know, help pay off their expense if they went bad, which is a kind of an odd thing for Australia. I mean, to ideas, no, we want to punish the people who are very successful and very efficient and large scale. We want to encourage lots of small miners by saying if they fall over, we'll help. I mean, that is a kind of, as a logical thing, kind of just doesn't seem to make sense. And then when you see how they kind of have progressed the practice of it, it doesn't give you any faith that, at all. And so just in terms of the investment in general, I think it will have a very bad impact, and that big companies do have, and this is when, you know, for example, Tom Albanese got given a lot of stick for saying it was the greatest sovereign risk facing Rio Tinto. They said, oh, for heaven's sake, you know, well, you know, look at Africa and look at Ghana, look at all these, you know, places. But in fact, in those places, yes, there's lots of disadvantages. And they actually now, before they even do exploration as a big company, they have financial stability agreements which guarantee the rate of tax, which guarantee the types of arrangements, precisely because they can't rely on the government. Well, Australia's never, you know, it's never been an issue, and suddenly people are talking about it in terms of Australia.
Especially here.
I'll ask you a question. You said that like investment will go down because of this resource super profits tax, but don't you think we have an obligation to look at who is investing in Australia currently and who will invest in Australia in the future? And a couple of weeks ago, the Indian Resources Minister was in Perth. His name is Mr. Shinde, and he privately spoke to Indian journalists and said the RSPT is a non-issue. He said the Indian government is just so desperate for resources that it is a non-issue.
Well,
it will come regardless.
That's right. Well, that of course is one of the interesting aspects. Particularly, obviously it affects India, but it also affects China, and that's one of those other issues which is, you suspect, not particularly well thought out. I mean, this government, although they don't say so, are kind of a bit apprehensive about Chinese investors in particular, but having the customers having too much control of the resources. You'd have a very big impact. Say Chinese investors, and again India to a slightly lesser, the people who want resource security will be less worried about the prices they get. The prices they have to pay for assets, and therefore they're going to have a slightly different interest in many cases than other companies who are just doing it for commercial reasons. And so I think it's quite possible that you would get greater degrees, particularly of Chinese investment in resources. It's not necessarily what the government had in mind at all.
Mr. Michael.
George, as your philosophic house of cards seems to depend on whether or not the public debate should be before or after the parliamentary debate, I want you to tell me why you use the analogy of the GST when there was a public debate before the vote in order to give the government a mandate to introduce it. And yet here we had no mandate, and in fact surely what we're having now is the public debate, the quite proper public debate before an election.
I don't doubt that, but I think I'm sort of still holding my original point. No one, it never occurred to anyone in 1998, least of all the trade union movement, which is the equivalent critical mass, to basically argue the toss with the government on the rate. It didn't occur to ACOS to do it. It didn't occur to the motor lobby to do it on fuel excise. It didn't occur to the brewers to do it on the beer excise. There was a sense that these things were done at the political level and the politicians could have a debate. And Tony Abbott could obviously run the case for the miners. I don't have a problem with that. As Kim Beazley wanted to run the case for the welfare lobby that didn't want a GST or for the unions. I don't have a problem with any of that. The problem I have is the idea of a lobby group being able to deploy resources to the extent that they actually risk corrupting the political process. Now, they corrupt it not by the act today, but by the precedent they set. And in fact, we've already seen the corruption of it because of the government's response.
It's a pre-election debate, isn't it?
No, but I'm actually talking about the sorts of dollars you bring into these sorts of discussions. Once you take it into the glorified spin cycle of electronic media, the government has already corrupted itself to try and meet this challenge. Now, this government is not that bright. and it's overturned its own code of ethics on paid advertising, but it's still done it. Now, I just think there are consequences for some of these things. But you know what? I mean, at the moment, we're still not debating. We're not even debating the theory of the tax. We're actually debating this idea of who saved the country from the GFC. Now, how this is actually off the topic. So, this is an example of the sort of debate you get. You didn't get the level of detail that you had in 98. I thought 98 was a terrific debate. I enjoyed it as a journalist. I thought it got a bit out of control in the end. We were trying to find all the losers, but I still thought it was a pretty informed debate. This one, to my eyes, is not an informed debate. In fact, I see...
I'm sort of a
risk it is. Well, I do see a couple of people throwing rocks at each other. I see a Prime Minister who wants to play class warfare, and I have a problem with that.
So
I see, but I also see miners who, you know, when did they become national champions? They are not national champions. They are multinational corporations. Now, a year and a half ago, Rio was coming cap in hand to the government, begging for the right to sell a fraction of the quarry, a significant portion of the quarry, to China. So I don't know. I don't know when suddenly the miners became heroes and the government became this thing to be defeated no matter what the cost. Now, as I say, I don't care about the Rudd government in a sense, but I do care about the exercise of power at that level. Because I think there is a precedent that I think both sides of politics probably don't even understand yet.
We're fast running out of time. We don't have a lot of time. We'll take one question there, and then we'll pretty well finish, yeah?
George, I'm the CFO of an Australian-listed coal-seam gas company.
Yeah.
All of our shareholders are Australian, just about it, right? Are you aware of any resources company that's in favour of this tax?
The question is George aware of any resources company that's in favour of the tax? We'll take a brief answer, and then we'll finish.
A company, like an actual company...
I mean, not all resources companies are multinational, large multinational, deep-pocket companies.
Okay, no.
There are a number of junior companies. Yeah. Most of the ASX is actually made up of junior resources companies.
Well,
and we're the ones that are providing sort of vast numbers of jobs in the regional areas.
Yep.
So I think that your argument around, you know, this is an argument being run by deep-pocketed multinational companies and large listed public companies,
well, no,
the suggestion is there are a lot of junior companies in the general industry who don't support the tax.
There seem to be a lot of people in the government and the Treasury who think that there are essentially two camps, Rio and BHP on one level, and a lot of other miners on another level. That could be wrong. But you see, unfortunately, I always take the ultimate position of the sceptic as a journalist. I can't take a vested interest argument on face value. I'm aware there are claims that there are, but I'm not aware of anybody who's been able to tell me. No, just hold on. This is actually, you know.
Now, hang on. We've got to stop the interjection because we won't finish. Yeah.
That's all right.
The question is, are you aware of any smaller mining companies who support the tax? I think that's the question, isn't it?
Yeah. I'm only telling you what I'm being told, and I don't know whether I believe it or not. But apparently there is a split in the industry.
According to Treasury.
Well, that's okay. I mean, that's okay. I get briefings from the miners every other day as well, and they tell me that Ken Henry is a moron. So I mean, well, you know, I mean, what sort of country do you want where everybody that is in the government or is a bureaucracy is a moron? I mean, that's not the sort of country. I mean, you've got to give these people credit for some body of work and some thought.
I'm going to ask the final question. To go back to where Jennifer started off, I suppose we're all a bit surprised that the debate is where it is now when this was first put on. Just looking forward a bit, where does George, where do you think this is going to end up? I mean, in the next couple of months, and then Jennifer, where do you think it's going to end up? And then we'll finish up.
I think there'll be a proposal after the election that will be legislated that looks nothing like the one that's on the table now. And I think the start on it is going to be so slow. I think at some point Labor is going to remember what it did right in the 80s, and they're going to rediscover the old growth model, which is the buy-in with business is to tell them you're on their side. And then when the revenue flows in the long run, no one's complaining. So I think this has been done wrong. But I suspect that a lot of them understand that now. I think Kevin Rudd has some sort of theoretical understanding of the academic model, but his first resort was to class warfare. And Kevin Rudd's attention span on an issue like this is almost willfully short. if I can put it that way. And I think it's already occurred to me that you can't win a debate this way. You can't win a debate by slogan. So I suspect the tax will look nothing like it after the election. My great disappointment is that Tony Abbott didn't offer to put all the miners in a room together and come up with an alternative. Because I still think we need a debate on the issue.
Jennifer.
I think we are having a debate on the issue. I think it is actually quite an informed debate, increasingly well-informed. I think part of the reason it's well-informed is because the mining companies are taking the government on, because if Tony Abbott had just taken the government on, everyone would say, well, he doesn't know what he's talking about, he's just opposing for the sake of opposing. So I, in that sense, completely disagree with George, and I think it's a very good idea because of the way the government has handled this. In terms of what happens in the next few months, I had thought initially that obviously there would be some compromise, and clearly people in the government, and some people in the government do want to compromise, but let's just put it this way. I think if Kevin Rudd is the Prime Minister after the election and Wayne Swan is the Treasurer, and the Greens to hold the balance of power, which is quite possible with the Labor Party as well as with George's point about the Liberal Party, I think they will proceed with a tax which is fundamentally not much different from what we've got now, and it will have a grave impact on the economy.
Many thanks. I know there are a number of people here who wanted to make comments or ask questions, but all good things must come to an end in its time. But we've had a great discussion. I mean, what you always find at the Sydney Institute is a real debate and discussion. We've had that again tonight. So many thanks to Jennifer Hewitt and to George Megalogenis for stating their case and for engaging in this debate. The copies of George's book, for salvage, Janet Grundy's got it. I'm sure George will be happy to autograph it. George has been here before tonight, and I'm sure we'll have him back. And Jennifer is a first timer, and I'm sure we'll have Jennifer back. And we've had a great discussion. I'll certainly know a lot more now than I did at 6 o'clock, and I'm sure that's true for all of you in the room. So many thanks for coming along, folks, and well done to both our speakers. Thank you, George.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.